Then here we go. It's WTC, our 81st episode of We Talk Comics. This one's subtitled Comic Book Urban Legends. I am with two out of the three usual co-hosts I have. It's almost the usual. It's the usual gang of idiots for most people. I mean, there's enough idiocy still left over, even without Chris around this week. Because we have Keith.
I am here.
We have Brett.
That's me.
And an enough idiot for all of Western Canada over here, Mo. And so we're gonna be having lots of fun. This is gonna be a great episode. I think everybody's gonna have a good time with us. But before we get to it, I let everybody know that Chris will be here with comic book. What is it called? Comic Book Attractions. Chris's Comic Book Attractions. He does what is it? Atlantis, the Lost Island, or whatever the hell it's called there. That Disney movie. Remember that one? Did anybody ever see that?
Yeah, I have.
Anybody? Oh, there you go, Brett. He does that.
I have the vaguest recollection of that. Is that a comic book property?
Interesting. I don't remember it.
It's not a comic book property. His theory is Mike Mignola was one of the designers of the movie, and therefore the art design, he says, is influenced by Mignola. So that's – I know it's a bit of a stretch, but, hey, I don't do it. And it brings Chris on the show and blah, 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 blah. We're moving on.
I buy that.
You buy that good enough.
Well, he needs to, considering how bad the movies are that he's been watching, he needs to find some way to stretch it, you know.
Yeah, well, is that a good movie? I mean, Michael J. Fox did the lead voice, didn't he?
I'm pretty sure he did.
There you go. So that's always a good start. Anyways, we're on to the weekly news with Cub Reporter K, as of course, hosted by Comicosity. Great website run by the two classiest men in comics, Matt Centauri Griffith and Aaron Long, and Keith, what's going on with the news?
Well, it's a late news week. I missed out last week on the episode, which meant I missed out on talking about Villains Month. So, Villains Month's happening. Now, there's a lot of complaining. Our friend Joe Mulvey spends a lot of time talking about how there's not enough cross-promo comics when these other big properties come out, when the movies and the TV shows come out. So when it's being done right, I like to call attention to it. DC Comics is partnering with Starbucks and the Apple iBook Store. They are giving away Grant Morrison's Action Comics number 1 as a free comic this week in Starbucks's. At least in the U.S., I haven't seen in Canada if we're getting that one or not. It's a free download.
Oh, that's something.
It is Superman week this week. Tons of stuff. Crazy amount of stuff. We've got.
That movie comes out this week?
The movie is out on the 14th.
Oh, so by the time this hits the airways, it'll be out and I won't be seeing it.
That's right. I'm dodging spoilers. The midnight shows will start soon, so I gotta. The Twitter may be in lockdown. I accidentally opened up a kid's book and read the first page and, like, already spoiled something. it was a kid's book called The World of Krypton or something like that, and one page told me more than I actually wanted to know. So.
Wow, you take this stuff seriously, man.
I absolutely do.
How about you, Brett?
I definitely try to avoid things whenever I can. I'm usually pretty good at not seeing anything. You know, I don't. I'm not sure that I go to the same lengths that Keith does, but I don't. But I don't try to see them either.
I get a great deal of joy from the surprise. I mean, the mid credits reveal in Avengers. Yeah, I felt like a little kid again. One of my favorite moments in Skyfall was when you find out what the word Skyfall meant because they didn't tell say that in any of the promo. I love those moments.
I don't know what it meant and I haven't seen it yet. Can you tell me? I'm curious now.
It actually only works in the story. It's one of those many things that if you're just, it's like the swerve in Iron Man 3. If someone just tells you, it sounds stupid.
Well, I know that.
Some people
already
thought
know
it was
that
stupid
one.
When they saw the movie. But,
I knew that one at least.
But it's one that, I mean, in the context of the film, I thought it was great. If I had just heard that, it would have actually colored the whole film for me.
Yeah. How about you, Brett, though? Are you in lockdown for Superman?
Well, sure. I expect it to be very good.
Are you going to see it opening weekend like Keith?
Oh, I never see anything opening weekend. I mean, I still haven't seen Iron Man 3. So, I mean, yeah.
Okay. So you already know the swerve in Iron Man 3.
No, I don't.
You don't? Tony Stark, actually a Krull. Skrull, sorry. Actually, he's a Krull. He's in that movie Krull. He's going to be Tony Stark has been cast in the next remake of Krull. That is the spoiler for those of you. Anyways,
and Buckaroo Banzai is in the post-credit sequence.
Well,
yeah,
that would rock. I mean, I'd be all over that.
There was one of the I try not to jump down people's throat on Twitter, but one of the silliest things I saw this week was someone who said that the Justice League movie is not going to turn out well because there's no post-credit sequence in Man of Steel. So obviously they're not taking this seriously.
Wow.
That's weird.
Wow. All right. What else is going on in the news?
That is a spoiler-free thing. Is my understanding is there is no post-credit sequence. You can save yourself that 10 minutes and look up the key grip's name on IMDb instead of sticking around in the theater.
I stick around because that way, by the time it's over, the bathroom's cleared out again, and I don't have to worry about. I don't have me a Stan Lee guy coming in there clearing out the bathroom for me like he does.
All right. Teen Titans Go gets a second season on the Cartoon Network.
Go, go, Teen Titans Go. It's
Brett
fun.
The only one that would be exposed to this one?
It's a great show.
Is it a good show?
It is. I'm not 100% sure that it's as good as the first round, but it's still really good.
Ratings are quite good on the show, and it is doing very well in its target audiences of the 2 to 14.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the 18 to 31 males.
Yeah, the ones that get shows canceled on the Cartoon Network. Yeah. Oh, yes. Doing very well with the kids. September, Marvel Comics will be having Lego variant covers, where their various characters will be represented as Lego minifigs.
That's interesting.
Totally looking forward to that.
That's kind of cool. What's interesting to me about that is you look at all the Lego games and they're Batman and Superman and whatever. It's not any of the Marvel characters. So that's interesting.
No, they have Marvel.
You get a Lego. Do they have a Marvel character too?
Oh, they have Marvel. Like the Avengers are all available in Lego.
No. I'm talking video games.
Oh, the video games. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I'd like to see a Spider-Man Lego video game. That'd be great.
Make it back into a system for that. I got out after I really didn't like that Batman one that they put out.
The Batman Lego or the Batman Arkham Asylum?
The Batman Lego.
Just try the Batman Arkham Asylum. You'll never stop playing video games again.
The investment to get back in now is a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, wait to the PlayStation 4. Close enough.
We've got the announcement of a new Valiant book starting in September.
Oh, really?
Yep. Written by Greg Pak, art by Trevor Harrison, Eternal Warrior.
Oh, well, makes total sense. He's been a character in Archer and Armstrong for practically the entire run. So
the art we're seeing.
We'll see.
Go ahead.
We'll probably see Ninjak shortly after that, since he's already made a run. And there's the cat, Scott. Angus, hello, Angus. He already has, of course. There's the show Cat Scott in the background. Brett, how's Angus doing?
Well, he's fine now. He's fine now. The panic is over. So
the panic of not being on your lap.
Yes, he forgot where I was. You know, so now it's.
All right, Keith, what were you saying?
And the last thing to hit is we've got from our pals at the Comics Chronicles the May sales figures or sales. Estimates. Number one book. You guys know?
No.
I saw it earlier.
X-Men. The Brian Wood X-Men.
That makes sense.
At an estimated 177,000 copies.
That's a biggie.
Sales are still doing well. So are you saying that's it for the news? Because I got a couple items then.
All right. Well, I'll touch a couple more things in the sales figures here. Batman at number 2, Justice League at number 3, a couple of Age of Ultrons, a couple of Superior Spider-Mans, a decent split of Marvel and DC over these, over the main numbers.
What about the overall, market share then? Do you have that to handy there?
I have it.
Apparently that's a no.
Why don't you do a story and I'll find where they bury that.
All right. Well, let's just talk about, you'll see that the Paul Jenkins interviews have started coming out online. And he had an exclusive one. The first one to come out was with Bleeding Cool last week, where he talked quite extensively about his displeasure with DC editorial, stating, of course, that they were choking him. Actually, it was the term used. And we hope to talk to Paul in person ourselves, but I just want to say before any of that, of course, we did break that on the air ourselves 2 weeks earlier, after giving everybody a detailed account of our conversation with him, private one-on-one conversation that he held with us that was not for the podcast, but we were allowed to talk about. Another thing I want to talk about, something that's big enough, this is actually big enough that's getting mainstream media, it's on CNN, it's on radio stations, everything, so we don't want to ignore this. Number one copy of Action Comics with a huge rip in the cover about 10 hours ago was sold for $175,000. So yes, we're at that point now where these old books are so rare now that it's no longer about having pristine condition or anything even close. With a massive rip in the cover, still worth $175,000, found in somebody's attic, I believe.
It's the wall of a house. It was part of the insulation, yeah.
Yeah, part of the insulation. So that to me is quite interesting that, it makes sense that we, I mean, that's nothing compared to the, $1.5 million that one was sold for in 2010, but I still think $175,000 for a beat-up comic book. So we're at that point where the rarity is that high now.
Time to tear apart your house, Mel.
This thing was built in 2004, Brett.
you can get a copy of Grant Morrison's Action Comics number 1.
All-Star Superman number 1 with a huge rip in it. Let's see what I can get.
The most awkward family dinner ever will be associated with this copy of Action Comics number 1, because unfortunately it was pulled out of the wall, someone realized what it was, and then Aunt What's-Her-Name tried to grab the comic and tore the comic.
Well, that's how it happened.
That is where part of the damage came from. So it's estimated that somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 damage in that moment.
Yeah, it still obviously wouldn't have been worth 1.5, but that damage did, I'm sure, cost a significant amount. Hey, what else you got, Keith? You say something about the overall split of numbers. Was that what we're talking about?
Yes, indeed. Share of overall units, Marvel 37%, DC just under 31%, Image at 8%, IDW 4.7%, Dark Horse around the same, and then everyone else is 3 and under. Dollar share a little closer, Marvel 33, DC 28, Image 7.
All right. That's kind of okay. Interesting. All right. You got anything else there, Keith?
That's the news.
All right. Then, once again, thanks very much to our great new sponsor, Comicosity. If you're not visiting them 3 to 4 times a day yourselves, you suck. All right. This week's big topic, comic book urban legends. This one, what we have here is there's a great blog out there. Keith, you're a regular visitor of it. Tell everybody about it and where they're hosting this and where we're getting this from.
Absolutely. It's on Comic Book Resources. It is a blog called Comic Book Legends Revealed. So they've been doing this for years and years. There's over 400 entries, most of them with 2 or 3 urban legends each. They're all comic book related legends. They've got a couple of sibling blogs on movie urban legends, book urban legends, but of course comic books are the ones that we're interested in.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. I perused these over the years and read a few of them, and I always enjoy it. Every now and then it's a time waste. So Brett read the first 300. They're 422 or 23 or something like that now. Keith, of course, you've read it every single week. So for that reason, what we're doing here, the concept is we're going to take some from the last few that Brett and I haven't had. You're going to say them and tell them to us, and of course we'll be discussing them, and we'll be discussing any other ones that are in there that you guys think are spectacular from the previously. But me and Brett are kind of try and guess out of these 10 if it's true or not. What is the reality here of these urban legends? And we'll see who gets the best score. And we invite you to play along with us. Winner gets to win. Let's go.
All right. So I've picked a stack to have you guys give a go to. Hopefully they're not ones that Brett has looked at before.
If they're after the 300, he should be good.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while. I'm very far behind.
All right. Now, the way they structure it is they say the legend and then they say whether it's true or false. I may reword some of these because the false ones aren't nearly as interesting. In the time is the right before the creation of Vertigo Comics, another company was trying to get a mature readers line off the ground. The urban legend is that this was Disney. True or false?
I gotta think that's false.
Wow, that sounds like it really would be false. I mean, I can't imagine Disney doing that.
Yeah, the only reason it sounds so false that you'd be guessing it's true, just because it can't be anything but false. You know what I mean? It seems too obvious. It seems like you're trying to trick us, Keith. I'm staying with false.
I am pretty clever that way.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with false too.
The answer is true.
Jeez.
The line was called Touchmark. They had lined up Jamie Delano, Kent Williams, John Bolton, Sam Keith, J.M. DeMatteis, John Van Fleet, among many, many others, Grant Morrison, Brian Boland. And they made it as far as even getting several issues created. Most of these books actually ended up at Vertigo later. Sebastian O by Grant Morrison, Mercy, Enigma by Peter Milligan would all end up at Vertigo.
Really?
Well, I thought that, like Touchstone was one of those areas where I thought, like in movies, that where Disney's tried to go for that little more adult feel. So I thought, you know, if it was true, then that was kind of my likely thought. But
well, who was publishing their, about that time, who would have been publishing their properties? Wouldn't they have had some properties published in Marvel?
I think they had their own at that point.
Okay,
it would
so
have been
that's
the mid
90s because that's why
I think they were publishing their own. Yeah,
I still think they
that's
do.
That's why I was thinking that. But really, okay.
They were licensed to Boom for a while, but that license has lapsed.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they have actually gone on their own again.
Marvel owns them. Or the other way around.
Yeah, Marvel owns Disney. That's right.
Other way around. All right, give us another one. We're both 0 for 1.
All right. In the days when Chuck Dixon was writing Green Arrow, he was told by DC Editorial that he was not allowed to give Green Arrow superpowers. True or false?
Yeah, because he created his own Green Arrow. That's where we got.
That's right, Connor Hawk. Yep.
Connor Hawk. So after he very early on came out to that book after Grail and killed Oliver Queen. So, of course, he was Oliver Queen's son. He was like a monk. I think it's true.
Yeah, I would say true on that one.
This was false. Editorial told him that Green Arrow had to have superpowers.
And he's the one who disagreed.
He was the one that was then forced to write it. They decided that just being good at archery was not good enough. He had to be superhumanly good at archery, which was then an inherited trait for Connor Hawk.
Interesting. I guess I never think about being superhumanly good at archery as an actual superhuman power.
You know what? Exactly. You know, honest to God, the only time I really read that stuff was when it would be like a crossover, with Green Lantern. And I was reading Ron Mars's Green Lantern, so I mean, I would get it then. But yeah, I mean, I didn't read it regularly.
Because
so.
He was a
like that
character.
Really, like that really, really brief. Oh, the new well, Connor Hawk, yes, Connor Hawk's terrible.
Well, actually, I mean, we haven't had a really good Green Arrow in a long time.
Lemire's run is amazing. these last.
I wouldn't go amazing. It's still Daredevil.
That new issue was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I wouldn't go amazing. It's solid. It's the only thing in DC I'm reading, but it's not amazing.
You're getting that. Well, you're getting All-Star Western too, right?
Just in trades.
It's
gonna be a while before I can talk to you about Booster.
another year or so, you can tell me what you thought of that Booster story. It's like that brief time when Spider-Man was just in the sales toilet and they made that weird, decision that he should be, which one, was he a mutant? I know Cloak and Dagger became mutants, Namor became a mutant.
Yeah. First mutant.
They played around with that thing that to survive the accident, they must have been a mutant to start with.
Yeah.
That was the Cloak and Dagger
thing. They did that. Yeah, and they also, you're right, they did that with Spider-Man too. Yeah. These things we will not talk about. Let's move on to another urban legend.
In Incredible.
I can't talk about Cloak and Dagger. To this day, I look at Dagger and go, oh, I can't tell you how many times I've thought about Dagger, and I realize now she's like 14. She's like, the character's like, I didn't realize that until years later, and I feel sick to myself about it. So especially wearing that outfit, I mean, jeez. Anyways.
I see a lot of Dagger cosplay. You think
that's true.
You need a lot of double-sided
calling for it.
And maybe you need Cloak cosplay as well, you know?
Nope. No, you don't.
You need a lot of double-sided tape for that.
You betcha. You betcha.
Oh, yes, you do. 14, I think. 15, maybe. Jeez. I understood her other name was going to be Bait. It was Dagger or Bait. They were up and down. They didn't know which way to go. But Cloak and Bait didn't have the same ring. Keith, give us another urban legend.
Yes, that's please. Right. Please.
That's one thing we put out there.
I'm gonna word this one a bit differently. So, in Incredible Hulk 418, Peter David was given permission to use Death, but so Death, the character from the Sandman, makes an appearance, but there was a restriction. What restriction was Peter David given on the use of Death?
Are you gonna give us multiple choice or?
No.
Okay, I'll just guess that the restriction. How is this an urban legend if we can't decide if it's true or false?
Yeah.
It's kind of, Keith, you're completely. All right, I'm going to say that it could only show Death from behind. Couldn't show the face. That's my guess.
Yeah, I would say like, you know, silhouette to off panel.
They don't show her face. The actual restriction given, though, was they could not show the Ankh.
Ah. So is that an urban legend or not?
It's an urban legend that he was given the qualification, yes, and given that restriction. And yes, that restriction was true.
So it's really more of a fact. It's more of a quirky fact than an urban legend we could say true or false to. Why didn't you just say, was the urban legend that I don't understand why you didn't just do that.
See, the problem
is... This is a perfectly fine true or false question. Death was given... Peter David was given permission. Peter David was given permission to use Death from DC, but that he was told whether or not he was allowed to actually have the Ankh symbol displayed, true or false. That would have been perfectly... Anyways, Keith, go on to another one. Save us from this. We're 0-3, Brett, but that one doesn't count, I don't think. How could anybody get that right?
Well, I figured there was a 90% chance that we were not going to get it. You know?
90? I wish the odds had been that good.
All right, true or false? William Marston, who created Wonder Woman and wrote Wonder Woman for years and years, William Marston was given a memo that he was required to reduce the instances of Wonder Woman being chained up by 50-75%.
Oh, that's got to be false.
You know, I've had terrible luck agreeing with you. So it's very tempting to jump out and hope for the other side. But I get exactly where you're coming from. So, I'm going to say true. I'm just going to roll the dice and try true.
I just want to say before you give the answer, I'd be more comfortable if it was 50 to 75% less time that they were allowed to chain up a dagger, because I think that's wrong. She's like 14.
From the desk of MC Gaines, president of All American Comics, enclosed is a list of methods which can be used to keep women confined or enclosed without the use of chains. Each one can be varied in many ways, enabling us, as we told you in the conference last week, to cut down the use of chains by at least 50 to 75% without interfering with the excitement of the story.
Brett's on the board! It's 1-4, I'm 0-4. How are you doing at home, folks? Or in your car.
Better than us.
Your bike path. Where the hell are you? What else we got, Keith? Let's keep going.
All right.
That's this embarrassment. Whose idea was this again?
Oh, wait a minute.
Say Chris. He's not here to defend himself. We don't want to say it's mine.
All right. Urban legend that in the Marvel Tales reprints, occasionally they would tweak something in the art or something in the dialogue, the Marvel Tales reprints of Amazing Spider-Man. And the urban legend is that they added a reference to the Dukes of Hazzard in one of the issues.
I think that's true. I'm going to say true. Not that I remember that, even though I used to get those, but I'm going to say true. That seems like the type of crap they would pull.
It actually seems like the kind of thing that they would remove. But no, I agree. It seems weird enough that I would say true.
The answer is true.
Yes, I'm on the board. I'm still behind, but I'm on the board. All right, 2-5, 1-5.
I'm just going to agree with everything Mo says from now on.
Yeah, and then you're going to go first from now.
Cruising
right?
to the
I went first for the first five. You go first for the next five.
All right. Jackie Kennedy Onassis, was a comic book editor. True or false?
Brett?
I'm going to say, wow. See, that again, the way you put that seems so weird, but false.
I'm going to say true. I bet you she edited like one of those romance ones aimed for chicks or something.
It is true.
Yes!
Ties it up! I will give a
this
bonus point if you can tell me what she edited.
I'll say Young Doctors in Love. No, I'm trying to think of like a one of those romance books from back then. Nothing's hitting my head. I'll say Archie. Because I can't think of anything else.
Not even remotely close. The cartoon History of the Universe.
Really?
By Larry Gonick.
Interesting.
All right, let's go with Steve Ditko. In the early 1990s, was working with Marvel to do a comic book adaptation of Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
I would say true.
I would say true as well.
And the score remains tied. Steve Ditko, of course, is a wacky individual who does believe... Love strongly supports the writings of, and visions of Ayn Rand.
So you're saying we're correct because you just said the score remains tied. Yeah. I'm still going. We still don't know. If
the score remains tied because you both got it right.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't going to do it like an out of 10. I was just going to go to like who's actually
Brett, 3 out of 7. We still have a chance to remain at a solid C plus.
That's right.
Our score.
Woohoo!
According to Bob Kane. When the Batman TV series became successful, it saved the Batman comic book, which was in danger of cancellation.
I feel like that would be true.
I've heard that before, so I'll say it's true.
It is not true.
Oh. 3-8, Brett, we're not going to...
Still tied, though.
The book did significantly increase in sales, and certainly he became a much more prominent character in DC in general. But the book was not at all in danger.
Okay. Two more, Brett. We're tied at three for some.
All right, two to go. And we've got, I'm just looking for the time on this. In the, this would be the Byrne, like Claremont era of X-Men. There was an editorial rule that while Wolverine was in costume, he was not to be drawn with arm hair.
Oh, that's false. Because I remember him with arm hair.
Yeah, I'd say false because I don't remember him not having arm hair. I mean, I did.
Of course, that might be the Frank Miller. That might be the Frank Miller miniseries I'm thinking now. I'm trying to remember the Byrne, if the Byrne had him with arm hair. I don't think he did, actually. Miller did, for sure. I still think it's false, though. I'm going to go false. This seems so stupid.
It is false.
Oh, okay.
That rule, however, did exist until Byrne took over the book.
Really?
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, so Cochran then would be a...
Yeah, if there's some sample art of Cochran's era, and when he does not have a shirt on, he has arm hair, and when he does not.
Wow.
It's one of his superpowers.
That's a pretty good superpower.
But Byrne started the fuzzy Wolverine era.
I also have superpower to get my hair removed.
Don't know what to do with that.
No mutant.
Sorry.
Still tied up, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we are both 4 out of 9.
All right. Mary Jane Watson, her name, was a clever reference by Stan Lee to marijuana.
Brett?
You know, I'm going to say true, because I know how Stan Lee often needed, like, devices to try to remember characters' names. So perhaps this was a device to remember her name.
I think that one's false. I'm going to go with false.
This will be the clincher.
Yes, I will. And I was going to go with that even if you had said false.
And now, because I watched the, you know, the cooking competition shows and those kinds of some of those reality shows my wife every once in a while, I've got to go. And now the winner of the Urban Legends competition, and then we need like a don't
we cut to a commercial break right here,
and then we need a commercial break, and then we need to recap.
You'll find out right after these messages.
Boom. The winner is Mo.
Oh
yeah, I knew it.
This is false.
It seems to me like Stan Lee wasn't that hit. Like, cause like this was when he did Spider-Man. This was what, like, when did Mary Jane show up? Like
65? Good. Well, almost worth an extra point there. 1965.
Yeah, that was a good guess. Yeah.
He was 42. And he said in an interview in Maxim in 2002 that he had never heard that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, he was in his late 70s then. So, I mean, he wasn't that hip is what I'm saying. I just don't see it, yeah, being that that thing. So, 1965, I just didn't think he'd be that hip. So, yeah, okay, good. Mo wins. Let's talk some more about how great I am then. No, let's talk about some more ones that you guys remember that you've read from this. Any other ones that you guys thought were particularly fascinating that you could recall? Again, this is Comic Book Resources. Again, you can get these at really, really good. Most, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have either heard of it or regular readers. But if you're not, check it out. But any more that kind of stick out in either one of your minds?
The Hank Pym one. The Hank Pym one I've gone back to many times. The infamous story where Hank Pym hit Wasp was covered as an urban legend. Because the writer never intended the scene to play out the way it does in the finished comic. It was a misunderstanding by the artist who made it more dramatic than intended. What was intended was that he pushed her out of the way,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, it's not an unviolent act, but it's certainly not hitting her. And the artist threw in a couple of speed lines and went a bit far with it. Jim Shooter was the writer. I can't remember the artist's name escapes me. I believe it was Buscema, but I'm not 100%. Even though I'm, and so, but because of that, or 30 years now, Hank Pym Whitefield.
Interesting. Brad, I know you have a historically bad memory for these type of things. You remember them when people bring them up. I remember every single detail, but recalling them themselves is not always the easiest. But any that you can remember or any more for you, Keith?
Well, often for me, actually, it's the copyright ones that I find the most interesting, and whether or not, you know, like what people are kind of actually saying about the copyright issues is true or not. Now, and there's been so many of those. I mean, whether it's the Superman fight, whether it's the Ghost Rider fight, whether it's, you know, even just the whole concept of whether they're, you know, pushing a character out in a miniseries to kind of, you know, re-up the copyright on the character. And so those are the ones that, as a general rule, I find very interesting.
That stuff drives me nuts. Copyright doesn't expire like that.
I know. And that's the
trademark expires like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But copyright doesn't expire like that. Oh, that one just, and it's a constant. I even saw Terry Moore say basically the same thing on Twitter a couple of days ago. He should, and like someone who actually has to protect his own trademark, he should know the difference between the two and which one expired, but no.
Yeah, there's a fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I've fallen for that one too.
Yeah, there's a fantastic video about copyright, and especially like, you know, in Disney and all the copyright that they push through, and, you know, how the laws have changed.
Well, and the nonsense of they have to change Superman's origin to maintain copyright, which hasn't, you know, it's one, it's not true, and two, none of the changes that happen when they're talking about this are fundamental enough to actually affect a trademark lawsuit anyway. Because that story came up with the Red and Blue Superman, it came up with the revamp for Grant Morrison's Action Comics. I just saw 2 days, the one Terry Moore mentioned it about the movie. It just will not go away.
Hey, I'll just say a Bob Hall, drew that, Hank Pym
thing.
Oh, Bob
Hall, thank you.
Yeah. John Buscema apparently was his mentor and taught him to always draw a very extreme action. So he was following that, and Bill Sienkiewicz was upset that Jim Shooter hadn't gotten him to draw because he could immediately, apparently Shooter claims that he immediately saw through the mistake and says he would not have made that. Did I pronounce his name right correctly there, Brett? Bill Sienkiewicz? I know you're a huge fan. Am I getting that right? Sienkiewicz. So I'm not even close. That's how is Bill Sienkiewicz's name pronounced is probably the next urban legend that we'll see on this blog.
Yeah, because I don't think Brett's right there either. I think it's Sienkiewicz.
Yeah. Sienkiewicz, yeah.
I know.
It's.
And how do you, Fabian Nicizia?
Yeah, never again.
Yeah. All right. Any other ones? Keith, of course, it's time now for some Wii views because we are.
Here I come to save the day.
Saving you from bad comics.
Absolutely. We got a whole schwack to get to. Interesting stuff. Let's start off, Keith, with Six Gun Gorilla. Do you want to open up on this sucker?
I can talk some Six Gun Gorilla. I really enjoyed this book. It took a bit to settle in, to get where they were going. It's almost steampunk. It's wacky. It certainly sets off in an interesting direction with these pen and ink pages, and then what looks like an old pulp advertising page, an old comic book advertising page. You get your packet of stamps, etc. And then it's a neat mix of steampunkish and Civil War and dystopic future. I was quite taken with this book. I'm really interested. I meant to look up what else Simon Spurrier has done.
Jeff Stokely, of course, does the pencils on this, and he does a nice job too, complimenting just kind of the style of the story and the style of the book. I think this book, I mean, I don't know what's really going on, but, you know, I don't know what's going on with East Meets West either, and I'm reading that. It's a little confusing what's going on, but not in a way that turns you off, just in a way that's going, oh man, there's a lot happening here. but you don't feel overwhelmed. I think this book is just a hell of a lot of fun. And the art style too, like I say, this, kind of reminded me a little of Kyle Baker, actually. It's kind of got this cartoon look to it, but I think it suits the story really well, and I liked it quite a bit. I also agree that this is going to be added to my pull list, personally. Brett?
Well, I thought that this one had definitely had a ton going on. About half of it, I would say, I didn't like, and about half of it I thought was really intriguing. So there's a little bit of a war going on with me as to where I sit with this book, and I think that I'm glad it's a mini-series, because a regular series I would definitely tip over to, no way, I'm not going there. A mini-series probably sits on the, when it's finished, I will, if I see it, I will probably read the whole thing, and I'll probably like it, but again, that could tip and go to I could hate the whole story too. So it's very much on the fence for me. There's enough there that I probably will read it, but not enough that I could say I'm adding it to a pull list.
All right. Well, that's from Boom Studios, if you want to check it out, of course. And the big question I got to ask for you guys, of course, this is an interesting book because let's not forget, lose track of the site that it's about a gorilla who also shoots guns.
You know what? If there wasn't a gorilla that shot guns, I would definitely be saying no.
No, but that is, but who wins? Tiger Lawyer, Six Gun Gorilla in a fight. Who you got, Keith?
I think that the Tiger Lawyer gets a stay of execution.
Sounds good to me. No matter what, did you know there's a book, Brett, about a tiger who's also a lawyer?
I had not heard. That's amazing.
It's a thing. It's actually a thing. It's pretty cool. All right, Keith, let's move on. Let's talk about, what was it, Gollum? What was it called there? No, not Gollum.
Breath of Bones.
Breath of Bones, A Tale of the Gollum from Steve Niles and Dave Watcher, published through Dark Horse. What do you think of that one?
I was quite taken by the art in this book. This was, it's a bit like John Severin, not quite as clean. A bit of watercolor style to the inking. And I couldn't figure out where this book fit as far as tone went for quite a while. But the payoff of this first issue, I really liked. I'm interested to read the whole run. It is a 3-issue miniseries. I may wait for trade just because, this is the kind of book that I think will be nice as a big unit. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was an interesting couple of characters they introduced, and I'm looking forward to what they're going to play with here.
I'll also mention the art because some tremendous backgrounds by Watcher, but even better, character design. Like, the character design here is tremendous. Everybody has a very distinct, unique look to them that was realistic in a cartoony way. It was almost, it was really, really stood out to me. It's a book that's, Steve Niles, you're just expecting a horror book. I mean, he's incredibly prolific and he usually does good work. He does a lot of books, so not everything's going to be awesome. So this is almost, at least in the first issue, I'd say it feels much more like a war era drama. But there is a supernatural element to it, though we only see hints of it in this first issue. I have the feeling by the time that this is collected with this dialogue and the tone of the story and the characterization, that this is collected and all three issues are out there, that this is going to be a spectacular read. I definitely recommend it. Brett?
Oh, this is bar none my favorite book of the week. I thought the art was spectacular. The characterization was amazing. The storyline was just awesome. I had, like, Steve Niles is hit and miss. This is definitely a hit for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Keith, we're moving on. We're plowing through the reviews this week. Let's talk The Crow Curare.
Curare.
I'm saying that. Curare. The Crow Curare. What does Curare stand for, Brett?
I don't know.
I actually did not get a chance to read this one. Curare is a poison.
That's what I thought it was that, but...
Brett, did you read it?
I did.
Nine years working for a mystery theater.
Okay. Well, it's too bad you didn't read it. I'll just go on then. It's a story that we've seen a million times. So quite honestly, I mean, that's the negative. That's the only negative I'll say about this. We've seen a story about a police officer who is driven by his work, who many years later is a notorious story told in flashbacks many years later, is still haunted by the case he couldn't solve. I mean, you've seen that a million times before. That said, the characterization and pacing and the dialogue were just great. I mean, James O'Barr actually wrote this himself. Of course, The Crow, you don't see anything to do really with The Crow in this, though a hint again at towards the end. A real pleasant surprise to me. O'Barr most of the time feels to me like he's just the first time I read The Crow, I was like, that's such a personal storyline. That's what made it great. And since then, it's felt very often like he's just, cashing in on the name of The Crow, and the series themselves have been very good. This is the opposite. This, again, feels to me like a very personal story. It didn't have to be told but through The Crow. Maybe it's done just for marketing purposes, or maybe he's going to have a twist. But very big surprise for me. I was very pleasantly surprised with this book. Another one I like. We're really on a roll here. Brett, what'd you think?
Yeah, I was totally shocked with this book because I don't even necessarily know why I read it, because he's been struggling so long to try to make The Crow relevant again.
I know. I was the same way. I read it just going, what the hell? But expecting it to get like six pages in.
Well, and I think that was also part of it, was that, you get six pages in and you're like, oh, you've seen this story a million times, like you say. But then the more that you read the book, the more that you come to the realization that you do care about the character. You are
so well crafted.
Yeah.
It's so well crafted as a thing. Yeah. Get drawn in.
This reminded me of a lot of the earlier Vertigo miniseries kind of thing. It was just really nicely done with art that perfectly matched the story, and just overall like a really good comic book.
Yes. Another one that you're looking at, I agree, Brett, the art, I was prepared to hate it.
Yep.
Because it just doesn't look good those first few pages. But it so well suits what he's doing,
Yeah, once you're into the story, you're hooked.
Definitely read that one, folks. Another one. Like I say, we're really rocking here. Keith, let's get over to The Killjoys from Dark Horse. This, of course, one is by Gerard Way, Sean Simon, and Becky Cloonan. What did you think of Killjoys? What's the full title there? Killjoys? What is it there?
The true lives of the fabulous. This one took me some trying. I quite enjoy Becky Cloonan's work. But it took two goes through this to really get a feel for it. I still don't quite know whether I really liked it or not. It's a dense read. It certainly doesn't unpack a whole lot in the first issue. It has a lot of content, a lot of stuff being pushed at you, but not a lot of context. So I'm curious enough to try a second issue. If it stays this dense, I don't know if I would stick with it. Because I'm not getting a great feel for who the various characters are or which ones I'm actually supposed to be paying attention to. But that said, I do really like Clinton's art, so I'm willing to give it a second try.
I wanted so badly to love this book because the design of the world is so fantastic. The set design, for lack of a better term, is almost, like you say, again, another steampunk dystopian future type thing. It's so great. But I got to say, this passes East Meets West for most confusing, wackiest book of the year. Like, I don't know what the hell is going on. Like, I read through it twice too, and it's like, I mean, it's edited by Sarah Hahn and associate editor Jim Gibbons, and I really feel like they let the writers and artists down here in way Simon and Cloonan, because they didn't manage to find a way to tighten the story and give them the advice they needed to tell a proper story. Because I mean, the characters, the book design too, like the back covers and the front cover, like the way they did this, using all the pages again, really great, great job. But I wanted to love it, but I just, at the end of the day, I just go, I don't know anything or who anybody is. It doesn't make any sense. Brett?
Well, first thing, you know, Becky Cloonan rocks the party. She's a hell of a penciler and does a great job with this. I anticipated confusion, but at the same time, I'm such a big fan of Gerard Way's Umbrella Academy that I am totally willing to give this one a pass, and I would absolutely say I will read the whole thing when it's finished, because that was such a good work that I expect the similar kind of things. He's a very Grant Morrison-esque conceptualizer, I think. And so there's a lot of, you know, levels and sub-levels and such that comes into the work. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. This first issue is not a very good description of what's going to come, I would expect, but for me, I'm in because of Umbrella Academy, but I totally understand why you wouldn't be in, because it's kind of a mess.
All right, moving on to a second book from IDW. Much like The Crow, we have Thumbprint Number 1, written by Jason Ciarmalia, and I'm just guessing on that one, folks. I think we all would be. And art by Vic Malhotra.
Malhotra.
I'm guessing on that, too.
Malhotra or Malhotra?
I think it's Malhotra.
Ciarmalia?
We've met him. You know.
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult to know for sure, but Thumbprint Number 1. Let's mix it up. Brett, what do you think?
All right. I thought this was a pretty good comic book overall. It was an interesting story of a person who came back from Iraq and was kind of done some pretty bad things, and the past is kind of catching up to her. But overall, I thought Vic's art was really nice. Like, he's worked with Ryan on Tiger Lawyer for a while, and a tiger who's a lawyer, amazing. But it's good to see him out there doing something else. And overall, this was strong. It was stronger than I expected. So I would probably come back for the rest.
I think that for me, this felt just a little bit flat. I'm not going to come back for it. I don't think it's a poorly crafted book. The dialogue's not bad. The characters, I think it's a little bit too slow paced. And it's very character driven. But if it's going to be that character driven, I have to find the characters either A, fascinating, or B, likable. And I didn't think the character was likable or fascinating. I do feel like some of the scenes where they're showing us, it's what the characters and the situations are. How, like, there's a scene in here, a torture scene, and it comes across more like how the writer thinks these things should go than how these things actually go. It feels like a series of cliches and such to me. So I don't think it's that bad. I think it will have its fans. I think it's worth trying for everybody. For me, it's not a go. Keith.
Finally, we have conflict and disagreements. I thought this was book of the week. I was really into this book, interested in the character. I think the moment that this character, that the lead character in this book worked for me was when, she's narrating the story. It's, you know, first person story. And it's the moment where she says that her dad died right before she got back to the States. And there was no one there to judge her. There was no one to tell her that she had screwed up. That was the moment that this character really, really got me. And I'm very interested in where they're going with the story. I do like Joe Hill's work. This is based on a Joe Hill novella. I need to start reading some other Joe Hill work. I've come across his stuff at IDW a couple of times now and always enjoy it. Very, very much into the rest of the series and interested where this is going to go.
All right, Keith. I think this one is a one-shot, if I'm correct. It's an American Vampire Special, The Long Road to Hell, Number 1, by Scott Snyder and Raphael Albuquerque, through Vertigo, of course, in DC.
Which I didn't read.
Oh, Keith, you said you read everything. This is Book of the Week. I mean, no crap, this thing's spectacular. Like, I read the one shot to the miniseries and, or the first issue of the miniseries they did with, American Vampire and, the Dracula one. And I thought that was great, but I never read any of the rest because I always wanted to go back and read American Vampire based on that. And I didn't, though. I just haven't had time to catch up on it. And then I read this. I'm like, I don't know the world, the characters. It doesn't matter. It's so well written. It's just well drawn. Like, just, this is as good as comics get. I rave about this awesome book. Brett, did you have a chance to read it?
Yeah, I read this one. It actually doesn't take that long to read overall, which is good.
Nice,
but
thing about it. It's 58 pages, and yet it hardly takes any time at all. But that's not in a bad way.
No, absolutely not. The characters are great. The story's great. This is it's one of those cases where I'm not that into, you know, American Vampire and the mythos, and I don't, like, it's just not my thing. Vampires just aren't really something
that
I dig.
Vampires are. I agree.
And you know, Scott Snyder for me can be hit and miss, but I'll tell you right now, like, Scott Snyder has really been more hit than miss, and yeah, you're right. This is a fantastic book. It's well worth having read.
Like you say, it's very well character driven. There's some twists in this storyline and the characters you don't see coming. Like I say, I'm not a vampire guy either, like you, but couldn't you see this? Forget throughout the American Vampire part of it. You could turn this into this feels like a 90-minute road movie special that you could see, you know, on that would be on HBO or in the theaters or something. Like, you could easily just, that's how it translates so quickly and easily, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, like it's really Snyder at his best, and I mean it's got elements of Severed with, you know, American Vampire. I just, you know, it really works.
Yeah, let's talk about, at least in my opinion, Scott Snyder not at his best, as he and Jim Lee did Superman Unchained. I think you're getting an idea of how I felt about it. Brett, what did you think of it?
Well, I think for the first 10 pages, I was definitely, you know, along with you on that. It wasn't really clicking for me at all. I think really it started to click for me probably right near the end. The last page intrigued me, you know, before the epilogue, which didn't do much for me, but I think that there's something there, and I will say that this is from what I've read, this is the best Superman book that's being published today. Of course, that could still put it at like a 4 out of 10 and still be way better than anything else that they're publishing with Superman. But the art is about as unspectacular as you can humanly get. I'd rather have any artist on as opposed to Jim Lee, because he's just, I don't know, does he just, like, is this a factory job for him now? I think penciling is half of what he cares about now, and so that was rough. But I would probably read it to find out more about the last page, but that's about it.
Well, I'm very disappointed in this book. I was hoping, especially since I read this right after American Vampire, I was really hoping it would click for me. I mean, it does, if you haven't read Superman since whenever, like I haven't, and I'm sure Brett haven't, it does nothing to tell you. It references a whole ton of stuff, does nothing to really tell you or pace it in a way so you'd understand what they're talking about. The only reason it seems vaguely familiar is because it's still Superman. If it wasn't for that, I don't think it would be familiar at all. I don't think the storytelling-wise, the narrative is weak, and you're right, the art is horrible. You talk about that last page, and while you said it's intriguing, good Lord, that piece of art is Rob Liefeld, with his eyes closed, draws a better panel, a better page, splash page than this. It's so bad. And the scary thing is, you talk about even Dustin, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Nguyen?
Nguyen?
Is that how you pronounce this? Nguyen?
Nguyen, probably.
Nguyen? Even his art in the epilogue is awful. Like, it's just, the art in this book is so bad, but also, I don't like the General Lane character. I feel like it's just, it has always come across to me like a poor man's General Thunderbolt Ross, and I don't need that. I just don't think this was very good.
I hope he becomes Red Superman.
Yeah, he might. Keith.
Well, I'll start with the positive stuff. There are pages with more than 3 panels on it, so this is a big change for Jim Lee.
That's true. He goes, as high as 9?
Yeah, he's actually got, you know, it's almost storytelling there for a bit.
A small bit.
I like the character stuff. I actually didn't think there was very much that you needed to know going into this book. Like aside from he doesn't work at the Daily Planet and he's not with Lois, I don't think there's really that much you need to know. And I don't know, it didn't wow me. I enjoyed it. It was fine. It wasn't everything I hoped and dreamed.
Okay, so I hate to interrupt you, but so here's Lois doing all this high tech stuff. I don't know where she is. I don't know what her relationship is with Clark. You say that she's not with Superman. By the way, definitely based on this. I mean, anybody could draw a better Lois Lane than this, but I mean, John Byrne still draws the best one. But I don't get any of that. Like the city itself, I don't really understand where Metropolis is or what it looks like. You know, there's a lot here, Keith, that really feels, like I say, because it's Superman, it's vaguely familiar, but it's not told in a way that is inviting for a first issue.
Where does Lois work? She works at the Daily Planet.
Then why is she still talking to Clark if he doesn't?
They still know each other.
But why is she giving him tips and such for stories?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Why is it that she's got this?
But I want to say that's bad storytelling within the book. It's not lacking telling you about another book. It's just not internal. It doesn't make any sense internally either.
No. Okay. So why is it that she works at the Daily Planet and she's got this? She's working at this wall with these. I don't know, Majority Reports or Tony Stark type wall where she seems to be moving around virtual pictures and stuff like that. Is that what's going on in this world and newspapers now in this planet? Like, all this just feels confusing to me. And
newspapers apparently are making way more money in this world than they actually are.
I think she's in the... Yeah, I'm not actually sure. Does it say in the book whether she's at the Daily Planet or whether she's with WGBS?
Well, no, that's another thing. It doesn't, right? Like, this is just little stuff that, like, it feels like nitpicking, but when it's a lot of that, it just comes across like, boy, you didn't do a very good job of giving us a setting
Comparing it to American Vampire is apples and oranges. I mean, because they're so night and day in their comic books. And quite honestly, I would pay $4.99 for American Vampire. I would not pay $4.99 if that's the continuously regular price for Superman Unchained.
Yeah.
I imagine this one's going to $3.99. I mean, But they stiffed us twice on this book, to be honest. I'm going to say, I opened the pages here. She is working for the Daily Planet because what she's doing on the Minority Report screens is laying out the paper.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Oh.
So yeah, she does work for the print paper. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, they charged us an extra buck for the
most profitable paper.
they charged us an extra buck for the poster. That you don't get if you buy digital, of course, even though it has the same price as the newsstand, the comic strip. And they charge the premium price for DC books on top of that. Cause, I mean, that's only, or they charge $2 for the poster. I suppose you could see it that way. But they have about a half dozen fewer content pages than $3.99 books do at DC. So they were really digging. They were money grabbing on this one, that's for sure.
Apparently they gotta find some way to pay Jim Lee his exorbitant salary for nothing.
Well, his page rate's gotta be unbelievable, especially considering I can't imagine he spent more than a minute 45 drawing that last one.
A rough one.
Sorry, you never got your full review in. Did you say you liked it?
I thought it showed potential. I was not as happy with it as I expected to be. I was a bit let down. I mean, it's Jim Lee, so my expectations were already pretty balanced. you know, Scott Snyder, yay, Jim Lee, Snooze Fest poster book. So it was, you know, I would say Jim Lee did better than I expected and Scott Snyder did worse than I expected. So I'll give it another issue or two. I will be looking at what that price point is next month, though.
Doesn't the cover suck, too?
Yeah, I don't. Well, there's like, I mean, if you're buying print, there's like 57 covers, so you can
find one that doesn't suck.
Yeah, of course, right. If you're buying print, then you're still overpaying, so.
Yeah, you're overpaying, you're especially overpaying digitally, but you're overpaying no matter what. Okay. All right. No matter what, generally a pretty good week for comics and definitely some good stuff to check out. And you know what? I'm going to say any opinions that you disagree with us, comics@wetalkpodcast.com is where you can email us. I'm Mo_WeTalk. And thanks to my co-hosts, Brett and Keith, for a fun show. What do you guys have to say before we go OUT?
Well, I'm Brett_WeTalk, and I would like to say that we have some spectacular interviews that are going to be coming up over the next month. This is going to be a great time to be a fan of WTC, and also a great time to be a host of WTC. So,
yeah, we're the only people having more fun than you listening. Be us doing it.
All right, you can follow me on Twitter @CubReporterK. Check out the Superman sale on Comixology. They've got 200 Superman comics, at 99 cents, including like 3/4 of the John Byrne run of, Superman. It's really cool stuff there. And a shout out to our pal Brian Willis. Brian sent me a birthday gift, which was ridiculously kind of him and completely unnecessary, but it was awesome. He sent me a Cyclops Was Right t-shirt.
That's horrendous. That nice job.
So, nice job. So check out Comics for Heroes. Find out how you can support that great cause.
Excellent. And
that's it for me.
Okay, like I say, we're all your cheese. Let's throw off to Chris talking about that Disney Atlantis movie thing.
Welcome to Comic Book Attractions, the part of the show where I remind you of comic book films, both good, bad, old, and new, that should be watched and enjoyed for what they are. This week, I had a little bit of trouble deciding what comic book film to remind you of, but finally decided this week is the week I am finally going to delve into the Mike Mignola universe. What film of his extensive back catalog should I take? This is a man that's been adapted so many times into film now. Hellboy, I just thought that was kind of way too obvious, both the live action and the animated. Both really don't want to touch that right now. We'll get there eventually. The Amazing Screw-In Head, a personal favorite. Well, just too awesome to delve into first. You can't do all the great bits right off the bat. Finally, I decided to make a departure from my regular rules of this segment, is that it has to be based on a comic book. I decided to remind you of Atlantis, The Lost Empire, 2001 Walt Disney film directed by Gary Tousdale and Kirk Wiseman. The reason I feel confident including this film in Comic Book Attractions is the film's visual aesthetic is definitely based on Mike Mignola's comic book work. He was one of four production designers on the project, and the film has gained a certain cult status because of that. Watching the film, I see his influences all over the place. And sometimes I find it an odd hybrid because you do have Disney-esque characters. A lot of the faces are faces we've seen before in Disney films. But you definitely see an effort to incorporate Mike Mignola's type of jagged edges and beautiful design. I find it quite a fascinating film to watch. In some ways, I think the two styles clash, but at the same time, there's such an effort made that it does blend. I can't imagine two opposite styles. I find this very interesting. Upon seeing a rough cut of the film, Mike Mignola commented that the hands in this film are amazing. And the people in charge did admit to him that they had meetings about how to draw Mike Mignola style hands. It's so cool looking at a story that is presented in the style of an artist I'm intimately, well, not intimately, but very familiar with. I have read so much of Mike Mignola's work, and then seeing his artwork or an interpretation of his artwork in this style that I'm not used to, or in this storytelling style that is so apart from his storytelling style. Really, truly interesting. Another quick comic book note. The first writer on this project was Joss Whedon. I never know how to say his name ever since he changed it. I don't know how much of his script got through. I kind of doubt a lot. First scripts at Disney don't usually go all the way through. Just a geeky side note. Now, I'm not including the trailer this week, as I usually do, because it is extremely... It's not an audio file. It definitely depends a lot on the visuals, and it would be lost in a podcast format. This film is sort of credited as the downfall of traditional Disney animation. And I can definitely see why. It is an hodgepodge. Without the traditional Disney songs, with the incorporation of CGI, which actually at this point is quite annoying. Really, this is one of the films that Disney really tried to up the CG content in a traditional animated film. And it is... it's distracting to say the least. Did not do well in the box office, and I definitely can see why. Did spawn a direct-to-DVD sequel, but every review I found of that is extremely negative. If you like Mike Mignola, definitely check it out. It is an odd piece. You do see his fingerprints all over it. I actually... went back to Hellboy comic book forms and started comparing some of the creatures, some of the lobster fish and like that. And it is so apparent what they were trying to do. I just kind of wish it was more successful. That said, it is an entertaining film. You will not be bored. But an interesting side note, I definitely am filing this one next to Hellboy and the other work in the Mike Mignola catalog. Now, this is something I never really thought to do. Definitely a different perspective. And if you are like me and you like to see progression and influences and like that, I definitely think this is worth a watch. Well, that's it for me this week. Until the next comic book attractions. This is Chris, OUT.